You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. Thanks for listening. We're continuing our series on the national security issues surrounding the rapid development of AI. And in the face of a lack of federal governance, some states have decided to take matters into their own hands, reasoning that the Supremacy Clause is only relevant when there is a supreme federal law in the first place. California, home of most U.S.-based AI innovators, has seen a flurry of bills seeking to regulate AI. Some of them have passed, some of them have been vetoed. But how do you balance the need for guardrails against the need for rapid AI development to keep ahead of our foreign adversaries? Do we really need an AI analog to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that gave blanket immunity almost to internet companies, including social media platforms? Well, tonight I'm here with friend of the cast, Margaret Hugh, who is joining us, soldiering on despite a head cold. She's the professor of law and director of the Digital Democracy Lab at William & Mary Law School, but she does focus on AI and national security. She's agreed to be here today. So hi, Margaret. I hope you're hanging in there.
Hello. Thank you so much, Lisa.
You have recommended a great guest today as well, Samir Jain. I hope I said his name right.
Yep.
Jain. Samir is the Vice President of Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology, but he didn't just drop into satellite into parachute into a 501c3. He has real bona fides. He was the Obama administration's Associate Deputy Director Attorney General at DOJ, and he was the Senior Director for Cybersecurity Policy at the National Security Council, NSC. We're going to put the full bio because it's a little interesting, shocking, and impressive, including a tenure at two major law firms. But what his bio suggests and means is that he advised leadership at the White House and DOJ on cybersecurity and technology policies. He coordinated the development of cybercrime and privacy legislation and policy on topics such as encryption and defense of critical infrastructure, something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, and responses to major cyber incidents, which we are concerned about. And he led the team responsible for international engagements on issues such as law enforcement cooperation, which is not easy. He can herd cats. He can herd contemplative cats that don't always move as fast as we do. They also discuss cyber norms and cyber-enabled intellectual property theft. He was totally successful with the Chinese, and they're never going to do it again. Darn it. He was a primary architect of the Presidential Policy Directive on United States Cyber Incident Coordination, and he played a key role in developing the executive order authorizing sanctions for malicious cyber-enabled activities. Long pause on that one. We hadn't done that before. This was huge. Samir, thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, level set for us. It seems right now like there are no guardrails for AI development or use. Is there a real legal framework that expands out from its application to just the federal government? Or really, do we just have like a collection of policies and ideas?
I think at the federal level in the United States, we're probably more at the latter, a lot of ideas and policies. So, for example, the initial document put out by this administration was the AI Bill of Rights, which set forth certain principles like non-discrimination, protecting privacy, safety, effectiveness, you know, providing notice and explanation. So it sets forth some basic principles for how AI should work. And then there have been some attempts to implement or put more meat on those bones. We've seen, for example, the NIST, National Institute for Standards and Technologies, has an AI risk management framework, which explains how to minimize and mitigate risks through things like risk assessments, governance, prioritizing risks. We've got the executive order that the administration put out that also has some requirements to implement the Bill of Rights, the government use of AI, as well as reporting around safety-related issues. And then we've had some voluntary commitments that AI companies have agreed to with the White House around safety testing, cybersecurity, and other issues. So we've got a lot of different pieces in place, but no really overarching legal framework. And you could contrast that with, for example, the EU, where they do have an AI Act that puts requirements based on risk, unacceptable risks, high risks, and things like that. Still a lot to be fleshed out there, but they have much more of an existing legal framework than we do here in the United States.
And though I do sometimes hear them criticized for the fact that they really don't have any of these huge companies in Europe, it's really us. And so really what they're doing is they're attempting to regulate us and the spread of our very successful, I call them the bigs, the big companies, right? They don't have an open AI or any of these massives right now, like Google, Microsoft, all of that. Let's talk for just a second about the concerns about AI development and how it could impact national security. Are there really standards that are set, like baselines for the data that is used to feed the models? Because sometimes I hear things and it makes me shudder, like, well, we scraped Google, we scraped Twitter, and that's how we fed the model. If I had a nickel for everything I ever saw on Twitter that was just dead wrong, empirically provable otherwise, I'd be very wealthy. So what do you think?
Yeah, in terms of what are some of the concerns around national security, let me start there and then I'll get to your question about data. So, you know, one of the concerns that people have raised is, will AI models make it easier or lower the barriers to entry for things like the creation of chemical or biological weapons, new viruses, or nuclear weapons? And I think there, the key question is there really an increase in marginal risk provided by AI? Because you can already Google a lot and get a lot of information about, you know, what goes into a chemical weapon. And really, the barriers in many respects are the expertise needed to actually physically assemble them or to obtain the materials. And up to now, I think while that issue has been raised, there isn't a lot of evidence that, at least with current models, that there's an increased marginal risks on that front yet. But of course, it's something that we need to continue to monitor. And, you know, part of what the executive order does is really to try to put in place some mechanisms for monitoring and making sure that as models develop further, that they don't cause some of those national security risks. Now, in terms of data, I mean, you're right that certainly the models that we think about most often that, you know, the large tech companies have created, they are in many respects built on, you know, scraping Google, scraping Reddit, scraping Wikipedia, you know, in some cases even scraping The Onion and not recognizing that's actually, you know, not meant to be true. And there aren't a lot of standards around what data can be used and limitations on that kind of data. It is possible that, you know, in fact, true that they're using untrue data in many respects. That's why we see things like hallucinations or false results coming out of some of these models.
But none of these current frameworks suggest a penalty or a consequence to either recklessly or knowingly feeding a model with false information. And I'm not aware, but you can correct me since this is your area of expertise. I'm not aware of anything that set cybersecurity standards for companies developing AI such that hostile foreign governments can't deliberately feed models with things that could be harmful to the country in one way or another, whether just cognitive warfare or something more precise like a search result that could have consequence for national security.
I think it's right that there aren't too many requirements around that yet. The voluntary commitments I mentioned with the White House included some commitments around cybersecurity. But just as we actually don't really have in many critical infrastructure areas more generally, a lot of requirements around cybersecurity, that's certainly true of AI and these models. So there is a risk, certainly, of adversaries, whether foreign or domestic, contaminating the models or the data that's fed into those models, or potentially even their outputs and creating problems that way.
Well, that's a thoughtful answer. I do think people are afraid of this. I think that is a concern of a lot of sort of scientific ethicists and people who are looking at this. And it could be that it's alarmist, you know, it's fluoridated water. Although I would point out fluoridated water is now a serious concern. Margaret, I want to bring you in. Thoughts here?
Yeah, I think that as a transition to talking about what steps states, for example, have been taking recently, would love to hear Samir's thoughts on the recent veto of the law in California that was proposed to regulate foundation models. Samir, could you help the audience understand a little bit more about that statute and some of the conditions that led to its veto by Governor Gavin Newsom?
Sure. So that was Senate Bill, I think, 1047. At a high level, what it would have done is to require companies to test their most powerful AI systems before their release for these kinds of risks, including national security risks or other consequential risks, and then expose them to liability if those tools actually caused significant harm. There was a lot of pushback to this bill. There was a lot of division, a lot of support because of the potential risks involved and because the models are becoming more and more powerful, but a lot of pushback as well in terms of the seeming lack of clarity as to exactly what the obligations were on the part of the model developers, how this would work in the context of open source models, for example, and what effect this would have on innovation. And it's those latter arguments that won the day, at least temporarily, with Governor Newsom and led him to veto the bill, along with a commitment to continue discussions with experts and potentially come back next year with a different version of maybe a similar kind of bill.
Yeah, Samir, I was wondering whether or not you had any thoughts also about the way in which, and Elisa, you and I talked about this, the federalism concerns about national security and the opening discussion in that bill. California basically said that they felt that they played a very strong role in trying to protect national security interests and that this type of legislation was necessary in order to monitor and assess the types of threats that were capable from these foundation models. And was just wondering, is this sustainable? Do we have a situation where it's sustainable, where you have states so actively involved in matters that have traditionally been left to the federal government?
Clearly, the better outcome here would be for Congress to act and set up standards at a national level, particularly in the national security area, and that we're uniform across the states. I think that's clearly the best outcome. And, you know, I think there are people in Congress who in good faith are working toward that, but it hasn't happened. And we'll see what happens with the elections. But I think there's a reason to believe that it's going to be difficult for Congress to pass any significant framework around AI, at least in the near future. And I think in the absence of that, states are going to act. California has some obvious reasons to act because a lot of the big companies in AI are obviously located in California. But we've also seen other states act. In particular, Colorado, for example, probably has the most extensive AI law in the United States at the moment. And what it does is that for the use of AI and what it terms consequential decisions, so the use of AI to decide whether or not to hire somebody or to provide them financial services or those kinds of decisions that really affect people's lives, Colorado actually puts in place a legal framework. It puts a duty of reasonable care on the part of both the developer of the model and the deployer of the model to avoid things like discrimination, requires impact assessments that are provided to the attorney general, provides notice. It requires developers to tell deployers about what risks their models may pose and what mitigation they have and haven't done. You're seeing states like Colorado move forward with broad AI regulatory frameworks, and I suspect next year, particularly if there's not a clear indication that Congress is going to act, that you're going to see other states move in that direction as well.
One of the things that I wonder about when I think about AI is the pace of development, obviously, but the potential for serious harm. Increasingly, medical decisions are made based on AI. Certainly, data is being collected for quite obviously that purpose. Is there anything that would make anyone personally or in terms of a corporation responsible or accountable in some way for terrible outcomes?
I think we're very much in work in progress in that regard. Obviously, existing laws apply. So to the extent that an AI system was used in a way that violated existing civil rights laws and discriminated against someone based on a protected class, that might still apply. But the question of who should be liable and who is responsible is actually, I think, a legitimately complicated question because the AI stack is pretty complicated. There are a lot of different actors here. There may be one entity that's putting together training data, another entity that's developing the model, yet another that's deploying the model or creating an application on top of the model, someone else who's using it. And where the responsibility and liability ought to lie across that stack is a complicated question, and it may differ depending on what question or what issue we're talking about and who has the ability to most clearly alleviate or prevent that harm in the first place.
Well, I guess one feature of AI development is that as a practical matter, there's no way to fact check anything that goes into a model when you're scraping that volume of data.
That's right. I think the quality of training data is a real issue because to the extent it's taken from the internet or other kinds of public sources, there's really no way to vet that data for the truth of the matter. For more specialized models, sometimes they're more corresponding, more specialized data sets. But even there, there are really no rules about how you vet that data set for reliability, for completeness and representativeness, because it's not only, is it accurate, but is it fully representative? You know, does it have data both, you know, for all relevant people of races and genders and things like that? Or is it just incomplete in that way? So there are a lot of different axes around which the data set has to be accurate and appropriate for the system to work well.
I think we've seen a lot of previous models go wrong, right? We had redlining in the insurance industry, which resulted in poor people of color and white poor people paying far higher insurance premiums. So that was a problem. That went on for 30 years before anybody really attempted to address it. And that's a very long time. But then secondarily, there's sort of a general information flow in the United States. I don't know if it's just the zeitgeist, but it does affect how people act. For example, it affects whether they bother to show up to vote in terms of sort of what is the popular narrative. And right now, that narrative is being dictated a lot by social media. And sort of the lingua franca we once enjoyed from things like linear television and, you know, the reading of common newspapers with editorial oversight really is gone. It's sort of a free-for-all. When you stop and you think, what does any of this mean for national security? Like, what are the precise national security risks from this? Have you sort of come up with a menu or categories of issues that you think are raised by AI that could at some point maybe be addressed by laws, assuming Congress would sit down and behave like adults and communicate with one another and perhaps employ some scientific expertise?
One of the real national security risks is the one that you were alluding to just now, which is what does our information environment look like and who can influence that information environment? Because we've already seen even before AI, certainly as far back as 2016, foreign actors trying to influence the information that voters were seeing about elections. And that certainly is potentially supercharged with generative AI and the ability to create both more quantities of information at a greater pace, but also in a more targeted way. So, you know, one of the scenarios that worries me is, you know, what if you on election day, we have more targeted information created by generative AI around the time, place and manner of voting. So, you know, someone generates and sends to people located in a particular precinct, hey, the school at which you would normally vote, there's a fire going on right now. So voting is closed right now. And says that falsely, but has the effect of suppressing, you know, the number of voters in that particular precinct. And if you're careful about choosing what precincts, could affect the election outcome in that kind of...
That happened this weekend. I mean, there were reports of that precise kind of misinformation working its way into an X and an Insta feed.
And the problem is if you do it on election day, it's not impossible to correct and fix it in time. If the elections are really close, it could really have a significant effect. But I also think more broadly, part of the issue that we're facing is that because people know that there are these potential disinformation, that there are these deep fakes, these videos that are created that show someone doing or saying something that they in fact aren't doing, that it's actually very difficult to know what is authoritative and true versus what is false. That's sort of one term that gets used is the liar's dividend. So that, you know, even as ordinary voters, how do you know what's true, what's false? And you see people taking advantage of that, right? So the gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina, Mark Robinson, when the media did some reporting that showed that he had been engaged on some pornographic sites and put forth some posts that were really offensive, his response was to say, oh, that's all been created by AI. That's all not true. And although I think we have every reason to believe, in fact, the information is true, it gave him a way to sort of throw doubt on, is this authoritative? Is it true? And I think if you've got bad actors, you know, foreign actors or, you know, even domestic actors who want to cause havoc, who can take advantage of these kinds of capabilities and really cause distrust in the information environment, create deep fakes or other kind of false information, that's a national security risk in a lot of ways, because it means the decisions that we make both as voters or maybe even as policymakers end up being based on incorrect information.
I find that especially troubling. I know, Margaret, you remember we were talking about that, that there's a whole category of American that are known and by social scientists as, quote, persons susceptible to influence. And they tend to be older and they tend to be more rural. And they have been the victims of misinformation over the years, particularly at the election cycle. And I noticed when I was driving back into town this week from sort of rural area of Delaware that I was watching a lot of these people were sort of putting out political signs. And I wondered, like, how easily and how quickly could they be deceived and how terrible that would be to sort of rob them of their independent will of choice as Americans and their real participation or their meaningful participation in the democratic process. But I guess I haven't seen any legislation or anything that just appears geared to sort of protecting something as important as the right to vote, which I understand is not memorialized in the Constitution, but we all understand that it's part of being an American. I don't see anything in any of these bills really that appears to be focused on that kind of protection or recognizes, as you say, how that is a national security risk. And it's concerning.
I think that you're putting your finger on, both of you, the ways in which geopolitical power battles are shifting. And we're moving away from, I think, traditional warfare methods and increasingly needing to fixate our attention on these very innovative systems of cognitive warfare and the exploitation of those that, particularly, I think, in the United States, given that there's a very large majority that are, you know, not able to access the same kind of educational benefits as others, that you have them more susceptible to these types of information warfare campaigns that undermine faith in our electoral systems, in our democratic institutions, and faith in democracy generally. And then where does that lead us if, you know, we don't have the same type of legal frameworks that we did before for traditional national security strategies and warfare? We don't really, I think, have the vocabulary or legal tools yet, Elisa, in order to engage in this type of new geopolitical battle that is going to be increasingly data-driven and AI-driven. These cognitive insecurity issues are going to really incentivize psychological warfare and cognitive manipulation. And that's where I think AI is particularly, unfortunately, the type of tool that can be used and deployed either domestically or by our foreign adversaries, or in some instances, a convergence of both working in concert and coordination together. I know that that is really difficult for us to wrap our heads around, especially given how expensive traditional warfare is. Because tanks and missiles are so expensive, but information warfare and data poisoning is relatively inexpensive, we're going to see our foreign adversaries, I think, invest more and more in those types of new cognitive warfare weaponry.
And I think a dimension of this, in addition to the misinformation and disinformation that Margaret just alluded to, that's worth unpacking a little bit, is the data question. Data is actually one place where you have seen Congress act a little bit in terms of, for example, it recently passed a law that tried to restrict the sale of data from data brokers to foreign adversaries. And I think that was driven in part by the recognition that large data pools about Americans can be used by adversaries, not only to train AI systems in a way that targets Americans, but also counterintelligence purposes. You know, if you learn about and enough about an individual or their family, and you can then use that as a way to pressure them to act in ways contrary to the national security interest. The ways in which data sort of feeds into AI and has become, you know, such an important part of AI means that the whole question of data and how you control the flow of data is very much a national security question now, too.
Building upon that, Samir, is the need for us to think about cybersecurity and data breaches going hand in hand with AI policy, because the more that you can just smash and grab and hack your way into greater and greater data storage units, the more you can aggregate the data and then analyze it for the type of AI weaponry or information warfare that we're discussing right now. And so completely agree with you, Samir, that this is something that we're going to really have to focus on, the data issues as well as the AI issues.
And Samir, just to, in point of clarification, the transfer of data by data brokers to foreign adversaries, was that in fact a law or was that some other legal tool? Yeah.
Congress did pass a law that attempts to restrict some of those sales, and the Department of Justice is also pursuing potential rules around this. Now, I think it's a difficult question because the law that passed by Congress, for example, restricts a direct sale from a data broker in the United States to, say, a data broker in China, but it doesn't really restrict sort of going through a middleman. So the data broker can still sell to a third country that in turn sells to China, and the data still ends up in China. So it's actually a hard question, I think, but it was actually a law that raced through Congress very quickly, one of the few laws that they've passed in this area. But I think it was really a first step, but a recognition of the problem that I think is a real problem.
And I want to thank everybody tonight for listening to NSLT. Our guest has been Samir Jain, the Vice President of Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And my co-host and also a guest tonight has been Margaret Hugh, Professor of Law and Director of the Digital Democracy Lab at William & Mary Law School. And she has like 50 other things she's doing. They both do this. They can do like 100 things at once. Margaret will be joining us as a panelist at the 34th Annual Review of National Security. She will be talking about AI governance and strategies, so you should certainly register, and you can look forward to hearing more from Margaret there. The link to the registration will be found in the notes to this podcast, along with things like a more fulsome bio for Samir, as well as some of the publications that his organization has put out for your consideration on the topic of AI. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend and to discuss the topics we've covered in a thoughtful way, hearing other people's opinions and arguments. This will improve your skills as a lawyer, a policymaker, and a participant in our democratic process. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country more diverse in thought than any other. Our producer, writer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the lovely and talented Holly McMahon, along with amazing members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We will see you all at the review conference. And if you're not there, we'll be disappointed. See you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.